You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History, and this is the last lecture in this series, Lecture 12, given on the 4th of May, 1918 in Munich. From the considerations of the day before yesterday, and in the wider context of recent public lectures, it will be apparent that there is a particular urgency for humanity to develop spiritual scientific interests at the present time. For spiritual science, among its other tasks, is in a position to provide humanity, and in a more focused way, each individual, with clarity in respect of mind, soul, disposition, and life's essentials, clarity for issues with which modern human beings absolutely have to engage. It was precisely from this perspective that I drew attention to the urgent need for seriousness in those wishing to approach and focus on spiritual science while allowing it to work upon individual souls. There is a need to attempt to investigate, in the most diverse areas, how humanity has come to be in such a catastrophic situation. The significance of this catastrophic situation is still not being seen in its full seriousness and depth by many people. However, the time will come when events, the facts themselves, will manifest seriousness by means quite different from those of today. Especially from the standpoint of spiritual science, it ought to be clear that it is not enough simply to wait until the last moment to grasp what needs to be understood in face of the deeply founded demands of this time. Above all, it is essential to acknowledge that certain truths vital to humankind, both at present and in the near future, are extremely uncomfortable, and that it is far more comfortable to go along with all the songs in praise of the great cultural and scientific achievements which have brought us thus far, than to focus on what lives and works in human relationships across the whole world, on what to some extent lives and works in conditioning present humanity. Present-day human beings are being challenged in many ways, and are necessarily being led into understanding a thing or two. But some things that need to be understood are simply difficult, and demand of us an absence of tentativeness and a prejudice-free discernment in regarding our own human nature. In evolution, certain tendencies persist through time. Hypothetically, one could say, it might well be possible to continue seeing as great what I mentioned yesterday, aptitude or intelligence testing. Some educationalists propagate this view, considering it hugely progressive, while the rest of the population avoids forming an opinion, finding it hard not to sleep through the Ahrimanic tendencies being introduced by way of testing intelligence and much else. If such efforts and ideals, after all they too are ideals, persist in gaining the upper hand, they will have a profound influence on the entire evolution of the human soul, and above all, a specifically configured influence on the fundamental forces of the human soul, on thinking, feeling, and willing. You cannot even ask hypothetically, as this should not arise in the first place, because the matter should be helpfully deflected by those who subscribe to an anthroposophical worldview. Yet you can ask yourself a hypothetical question to ascertain what you have to do about it. What sort of configuration would the main soul forces of thinking, feeling, and willing display if the present materialistic Ahrimanic tendency alone were to seize control? If no spiritual striving, no spiritual willing, were to counteract it. So enormously powerful are these effects in the field of technology, fed in turn by natural science and related fields of natural scientific endeavor, that human imagination and human thinking in particular will gradually and increasingly become imprinted with narrow-minded, bigoted characteristics. This cannot be described in any other way, and I would say that the beginnings of such bigotry and narrow-mindedness are already widely visible in our surroundings. It will consist in ever-increasingly transgressing against what was mentioned yesterday in my public lecture, transgressing against opening up our souls to the entire world. People will increasingly restrict themselves to hearing only in theoretical and intellectual terms what their ideas, concepts, and imagination are telling them. I want to state publicly that two people may say exactly the same words, and yet we are not justified in assuming that what those two people say is, in fact, exactly the same. Today we are living in an age of programs. The age of programs is one of intellectualism. What do people like to do best today when offering themselves and the cause of humanity's well-being? They found associations for everything imaginable and set up programs and ideals. These can, of course, be very sage, well-intentioned, and plausible. But for the evolution of humanity, they need not be worth a tinker's cuss. And then you ask yourself, what does the person concerned want? And when that person says, let's take an abstract example, everyone loves abstraction, I'd like to cultivate universal human love. Then you think, what could be more beautiful? Obviously, I need to join an association like that. Yet we live at a time when, due to culture having reached a certain surfeit, it is easy to set up the nicest programs with the nicest ideas. In the process, you can become, in terms of interest in the general well-being of humanity and its true situation, a very narrow, limited person. Nowadays, I'd say, you may sometimes be right, in a refined cultural sense, in matters about which, in the view of many people, you may be completely mistaken. For instance, you might find yourself valuing poetic stammering, which could possibly betoken inner strength of soul in reality, more highly than perfect verse, which simply arises as such because, as regards poetry's outer configuration, language itself, the spirit of language writes verse today and only uses the human soul for this purpose. Someone can still write brilliant verse within old formats, though they lack strong soul forces. Things of this kind need to be taken into account at a time such as this, when great, vastly great questions are facing human evolution. It has to be said, human beings must learn to open their whole soul to every other whole soul. They need to learn to place ever less value on the content of what is being said while gaining ever greater insight into the wisdom and power of what a person is actually able to place into the world. We are experiencing the most terrible world historical drama because right across the world people bow down to fundamentalism, such as that emanating from Woodrow Wilson. Because these fundamentalist principles make sense, because they cannot be refuted. Of course they make sense, of course they cannot be gainsaid, but they are as old as human thinking, thus it has ever been expressed. In all this there is nothing whatsoever to do with the real, concrete, and immediate tasks in hand. Yet people find it uncomfortable to involve themselves in real, concrete, and immediate tasks while developing mobility in their thinking. For this mobility in thinking involves engaging with the immediate, concrete tasks in hand. It may, admittedly, take quite a while to find your way into such concreteness, but it is important to understand such things now, and to insert yourself a little into the course of human evolution. There is a town peopled by a South German population. Here in the 18th century, an important person was born, Johann Heinrich Lambert. Johann Heinrich Lambert's contemporary, Kant, called him the greatest genius of his century. For had Lambert's ideas only replaced those of the so-called Kant-Laplace theory, something really significant would have emerged. Lambert grew up in a town in southern Germany, the son of a tailor, and showed exceptional gifts at the age of 14. His father sought financial support from the sage municipal counselor, who, after much deliberation, was moved to grant the gifted youngster 40 francs on condition that he never again ask for support. 100 years were to elapse before, in the 19th century, the town would fund a memorial to the man they hounded out of town as a 14-year-old. He had had to leave the town and, through exceptional circumstances, attained greatness in Berlin. Now, there is a fine monument in his honor, on which the globe of the world is set on high, indicating that this genius, capable of spanning the globe, was nurtured and flourished thanks to the very ground of that great powerful city. Sometimes it may take more than a century to appreciate the talent swilling around, something that may have persisted into or may still persist in our times. How often has it been emphasized among us that time has been edging onward and human beings need to wake up to free consciousness, consciousness that is dependent only on itself, consciousness in which people can no longer be allowed to sleep through all that is going on around them. That time has been approaching in giant strides, and people need to learn to open their souls so that they can see what is actually there. Because, as has been said, due to the peculiar configuration of materialistic culture, thinking and imagination are under threat from restrictive pettiness and chauvinism. Spiritual science provides ideas and concepts that do not allow you to become narrow-minded in your thinking. We are continually being challenged, precisely by spiritual scientific concepts, to view everything from various angles. This is what annoys some people among the ranks of anthroposophists, when they hear, "Here comes another lecture cycle, which will approach the subject from a completely different angle." It is unavoidable that issues are grappled with from several perspectives, so that you ultimately emerge with something I'd like to call, quote, "rendering discernment absolute," close quote. Truth captured in spirit is not easy to render in sharp contour, because spirit is mobile. So, spiritual science works against bigotry at a thinking level. It is difficult to say this at present, of course, but it is necessary. The second element which can be observed in the soul is feeling. In respect to feeling, the realm of feeling, what is the influence emanating from materialistic culture which aspires to affect human beings? One can say, in this area, especially, a great degree of success has been met with. Within feeling, materialistic culture causes pettiness and philistinism. Philistinism aims to grow to gigantic proportions, and materialistic culture is heavily predisposed toward enabling this. Petty meanness of interest. People want to close themselves off in smaller and smaller circles. But today human beings are not called to close themselves off in small circles. They are called to recognize that they are tones in the great cosmic symphony. Let us once again turn our attention to what is meant here, to what has been mentioned here, and view it from a comprehensive perspective. I would like to say, one can calculate, and calculating is much admired nowadays, how wonderfully the human being is integrated into the cosmos. In every minute, the number of breaths we take is around 18. Multiplied by 60 and 24, this gives us, within every day, 25,920 breaths. Within 24 hours, 25,920 breaths. Work out the following. You know that every year the vernal equinox, the point at which the sun rises in spring, moves forward, onward by a fraction around the dome of heaven. Going back to remote ages, at the start of spring, the sun used to rise in Taurus, further back, and it rose a little further back in Taurus, still further back, until the sun rose in Aries, and continuing further and further back, thus did the sun course through the heavens, seemingly naturally. How many years does the sun require to progress little by little, until it arrives at the same point once again? Making such small precessional movements, the sun takes 25,920 years to complete a round of the zodiac, as many years as we breathe in one day. Just think, What marvelously consonant harmony! We breathe 25,920 times a day while the sun moves forward, onward, and when it has done this 25,920 times, as we move inwardly with each breath, it has completed a circuit of the cosmos, of the zodiac. In this way, our breathing is an image of the macrocosm. And it continues. The average lifespan, which of course can be longer, though others die earlier, is some 70 to 71 years. What in fact is this human life? It too is a sum of breaths, but these are different breaths. During normal physical breathing, we suck air in and force it out again. Over the course of 24 hours, if we are ordinary upright folk and our nights aren't wasted, our ego and astral body make a great inhalation on waking and exhale ego and astral again on falling asleep. That is also one entire breath. Every day, one breath of our physical and ether bodies encounters our ego and astral body. How often does this take place over the course of a lifetime of some 70 or 71 years? Work out how many days a human being lives. 25,920 days. This means that not only do we reflect with our breaths over one day, the course of the sun as it goes its cosmic round, by breathing as many times in a day as the sun takes years to return to the same point in the cosmos, but we take the same number of greater breaths, breathing in our eye and astral body, into our ether and physical bodies, and exhaling these again, as we make in 70 to 71 years, 25,920. This demonstrates how our human life is integrated, number-wise and otherwise, into the great harmony of the universe. However many examples we might find, they would be no less astonishing, no less encouraging than rightly feeling what I have just described. There is a great deal concealed in the correlations between human and cosmos. But what is unknown has profound effects because it is actually identical with what was encapsulated in ancient times as the harmony of the spheres. This awakens our interest in the whole world. We gradually begin to understand that we know nothing of ourselves as human beings if we restrict our interests in Philistine fashion to our immediate surroundings. However, such is ever increasingly the hallmark of modern times. Philistineism, boorish ignorance, yes, Philistineism especially, has become the prevailing mood of the religious worldview. An underlying tenor of Philistinism has radiated into the minds of many. If you go back to the first centuries of Christianity, there are teachings which were magnificent. They were appropriate for those times. Today, they need to be complemented by spiritual scientific perspective, because differing times pose differing challenges for humanity. But in days gone by, those teachings, the Gnosis, were mighty. Just look in which wonderful ways eons of research and inquiry into the various spiritual hierarchies, the thinking of these Gnostics revealed. How this small earth is aligned within cosmic evolution, with its countless beings, yet within whose ranks the human being has been placed. Mobility of thinking and a quantity of goodwill is required to cultivate their concepts without allowing them to calcify or silt up, as is the way today, if one tries to elevate oneself to Gnosis. What then followed was not Christianity, but Christian denominationalism. Today you can ask around what it is that the majority of official representatives of Christianity hate most of all, Gnosis. Anthroposophy is blackened, mainly because they themselves don't engage with anthroposophy at all, being too smugly comfortable. And yet they have, if they dip into one book or another, a dark inkling or notion that for heaven's sake, this might be one such Gnosis. Quote, we'd have to absorb some new concepts. We'd have to make our spirits agile. Having finally led people to simplicity in their thinking, especially on the religious front, who can guess, they muse, what might ensue next if one starts raising oneself up to such heights? Close quote. They claim, quote, human beings can reach those heights and attain to divinity with the simplest of minds. There is no need to exert oneself. The simplest, childlike mind can reach the loftiest divinity at any moment. Close quote. Yes, you do need to see through such claims. It is a matter of really seeing through issues such as this. Everything depends upon it. Because it is from this source that the fundamental mood radiates outward into modern times, spreading parochial, bourgeois Philistinism. This is why the religious mood in the various denominations has become so narrow-minded. It is due to the underlying qualities just outlined. They flatter modern-day people who claim to be humble and self-effacing, but who are basically anything but humble, because self-aggrandizement and megalomania are also underlying characteristics of our time. Everything is judged, no matter how hard the experience, nor whether its hardness is engraved on one's brow. It will be judged, also by those who know perfectly well that they have not exerted themselves to gain wide experience, but have only bestirred themselves to arrive at the obvious, that they should not make much effort to recognize God, but that God will be revealed to their simple childlike natures, should he wish, at any moment. So you must see that above all this parochialism has to be resisted by spiritual science. This boorish, narrow-minded bigotry still lies in a different quarter from that which might widely be expected. And many of those who think they have gone beyond Philistinism are trapped in it to a depth well over their heads. Many isms and other modernisms, which have made themselves into programs specifically purporting not to contain any bourgeois attitudes, are nothing more than parochialism in a mask. That is the second thing. In the realm of thinking and conceptualizing, such encroaching petty-mindedness and bigotry, and on a feeling level the encroaching parochialism and philistrosity, have to be withstood. Instead, open-heartedness and interest have to seize their territory, together with the will to really look into what is taking place on the great tableau of earthly evolution. Yesterday we tried to portray in concrete form some effects of folk spirits. These are archangels. From this you could gather that these folk spirits are connected with the regions in which certain peoples evolve on earth. The folk spirit in Italy works through air, while it is through everything liquid that the folk spirit works in territories now in modern France, and so on in the ways I characterized. But of course, much overlaps with sundry other aspects, and one needs to be aware that though people live cheek by jowl with each other on earth, certain evolutionary phases may lag behind in one region or another. In some places, people will move forward, whereas other areas may be brought into decline. Now, something important can be observed. If we view the whole earth as one great organism and ask ourselves, what is taking place across the globe? We can identify various regions of Asia, or the Asiatic East, as some call it. In this Asiatic East, many souls are incarnating today who, through their karma, through what they have brought with them from earlier incarnations, remain in some respects within the idiosyncrasies of earlier times, souls seeking bodies on which they are able to remain dependent on their corporeal physical development into relatively old ages. It is the norm nowadays to be dependent on one's physical body only until one's 27th year. This is very significant in our time. Many phenomena can be understood if one focuses on such facts. I referred to one such earlier. I once asked myself, how would a modern person, one supposed to be typical as to all their work and activities, find their way into contemporary life? They would, to some extent, need to shut out everything that would normally approach them from outside, influencing them, to rely only upon themselves until the age of 27. This would necessarily create what we know as the self-made man. They would need to remain untouched by what normally and typically riddles our lives, and until the age of 27 would have to evolve in complete isolation and self-reliance. Straight after they had self-actuated, what a modern person ought to be, they would, for instance, be elected to Parliament. Doesn't being elected to Parliament represent a certain pinnacle of achievement nowadays? For if having been voted in they were to become, say, a cabinet minister after a couple of years, they would in some respects be stigmatized, because people would notice if they subsequently came unstuck, took a tumble to left or right, or suffered some misfortune. What happens then? How would they continue? They cannot evolve further. They remain a contemporary type, a thoroughgoing representative of their time. Such people are rife. Something I said here not long ago. One such person is Lloyd George. There is nobody who more typically, more characteristically expresses the trait of this age than Lloyd George, who, until the age of 27, manifested everything a person can possibly extract from their physical corporeal existence. He was an autodidact, a self-taught person, early in life involved in socialism, and learned early on that he, obviously, belonged in Parliament at 27. He was elected, and soon became one of the most feared speakers, and even, don't they call it that, quite a blinker or squinter, always sitting there and glaring when others were speaking. Lloyd George was known for having something peculiar in his glance. Then there was the premiership of Campbell Bannerman. People said, "What shall we do about Lloyd George? He's a menace. Best we make him a minister." And so they brought him into the cabinet. Yes, but into which ministerial post shall we put him? He's very talented. Let's put him in a job about which he knows nothing. That's where he'll be most useful and be least troublesome. He was made Minister for Railways and Shipbuilding. Within a few months, he had acquired the knowledge he needed and made the most brilliant reforms, among other great works. The present personality type cannot be better portrayed than by describing Lloyd George. He's like a concentrated extract of the prevailing materialism, and much can be understood about the present situation by inquiring into matters such as this. This is how things stand in a, quote, central world position, close quote, if I may put it like that, a place between the Asiatic East and the American West. It is particularly in European culture that one can, before the age of 27, extract from a physical corporeal level what can also be meaningful for soul spiritual purposes. A soul spiritual impetus then has to be awakened in the soul if one wishes to progress, and what is physical corporeal no longer delivers support. That is why, in a person like Lloyd George, everything is sourced from what the present, by its very nature, offers, and he possesses nothing whatsoever of what ought to be achieved by free effort. Naturally, the present provides much geniality, much gifted talent, but nothing spiritual of its own accord. That has to be seized in freedom. But in Asia, there is still wide opportunity to find bodies, beyond age 27 or 28, that allow for soul spiritual development to proceed in parallel. That is why souls incarnate in those regions who wish to extract forces from the physical corporeal beyond those ages. That is also why there is still a naturally self-evident spiritual culture there, a culture that still maintains that our surroundings need to be viewed spiritually, that what is spiritual be recognized in the world. There is, however, a similarly great decadence gaining ground in parallel, decadence that is due to the spread of a materialism most unsuited to that culture, hence the correspondingly deep decadence. But in leading personalities, one can see that this self-evident spirituality is present. They inwardly despise materialistic European culture, albeit in the most general way. People such as Rabindranath Tagore, who recently gave a talk on the spirit of Japan, and who said, "We in the East naturally embrace European achievements as far as external technological culture is concerned, but we keep it in our depots and warehouses and do not allow it, that is, European culture, into our living rooms. This is because spirituality is natural to him." We need to be aware of this sort of thing, because it typifies the forces underlying what is taking place across the world, and upon which world events depend. You will say, in Central European culture, we actually have the firm beginnings of a spirituality founded on clear, bright ideas. We do, indeed. And we can talk about that spirituality, as I tried to do in my book titled Riddles of Humanity, about a forgotten stream in German spiritual life. To imbue ourselves with a spirituality that would really go beyond what the Oriental spirituality has ever achieved, we only need to fill ourselves with the wondrous imaginations that we find, for example, in Herder and in Goethe. Oriental culture has not produced anything of the magnitude of Herder, who sees with every sunrise an image of renewed world creation and describes this magnificently. Those who do not want to be Philistines today prove, nevertheless, to be just such Philistines, who say, "We can't be bothered with that old stuff anymore." And if one asks people about Herder, he has long since been forgotten. An Oriental person judging conditions is naturally judging what lives in the current external stream of Central European culture. Just read the astute Chinese writer Ku Hongming, who has sympathetically described the culture of Central Europe, or read the lecture Rabindranath Tagore recently gave, and you will see how people are querying, what stance is this Europe taking in humanity's global progress? They have an inkling that Central Europe might be called upon to take the lead in going beyond what spiritualism could provide for them. But then they check as to whether Europe has failed to nurture the great beginnings, the great germs of potential which exist and are contained in Europe. People there had a Goethe, they say, yes. But those worthy materialistic Germans don't know what to make of a Goethe. When his last grandchild died, there was another opportunity to bring Goetheanism into German spiritual life. Under the incomparably excellent aegis of a German princess, the Goethe-Schiller archive was founded. This was given a great boost in the 1880s. A Goethe society was also founded, but was consistently too embarrassed to appoint anyone to head it who had really engaged with Goethe's spirituality. This was thought to be unworthy, and at the last vote, nobody conversant with Goethe's spirituality was appointed as head of the Goethe Society. Instead, a former finance minister was appointed. In the wake of such proceedings, the world may well judge what is going on in Central Europe. Goethe's legacy is being managed by a former finance minister, one bearing the symptomatic family name of Krosternte. But I don't know. Should the symptomatic nature of that name ever be fulfilled, whether anyone better might occupy the post? Such issues could only be changed if mean-hearted petty interests were to be replaced by broader interests, and if one were to observe how spurs of incentive actually spread across the entire world, how the bodies of the East, one might say, make possible a slightly lagging spirituality for souls who wish to incarnate into bodies experiencing this delayed spirituality, bodies that allow for an extension of what is physical, corporeal, for souls over the age of 27. In the East, there is a tendency to remain at earlier phases in human evolution, lingering in phases other sections of humanity have already undergone. Here, near the center, we are in a position where a reversal has to take place. One in which, until the age of 27, this age was 28 in the middle of the 15th century, what is needed by today can be extracted from what is physical corporeal. But for the onward development of the human soul, and if one doesn't wish to grow old prematurely and retain nothing of one's youth, a free soul spiritual impetus is needed in place of an unfree Eastern spiritual impetus. Moving further west to America, humanity is fashioned such that it is delayed in reaching this stature. In the East, humanity is in some respects delayed at earlier phases. In the center, you encounter that normal average age, whereas in the West, in America, as I characterized yesterday, earthly and subterranean forces are at work. These affect spirits like Woodrow Wilson, such that they become obsessed with their own words and principles. They are as if prematurely aged. But here, in a slightly different sense, more like prematurely old children who have not yet reached the full unfolding of what can be worked upon before the age of 27. If one could only see through what today makes such an impression on people, the question might occur, how is it possible that a spirit such as Woodrow Wilson, who despite his age has never absorbed more than would normally be absorbed by the age of 27, could yet become the global schoolmaster? The breadth of interest that enables a true evaluation of such things in one's soul is simply not present. There is no will to transcend philostrosity. That remarkable trait in the evolution of humankind can be characterized as follows. Going from east to west, from the retention of something earlier through a normative center to Western decadence, all this obviously applies to the evolutions of populations and the earth, and not to individuals themselves. An interest in all this needs to be cultivated in order to discover what impulses are at work across the world and how one is to value them. Here, in the middle zone, the decisive traits have over long centuries come from the south, so that influences from the Greco-Roman world have saturated Central European culture. A conservative quality accompanied this. Today we are at a turning point. A particularly progressive element from the north needs to permeate populations in Central Europe. I would call this particularity a beneficial impetus from ancient Hyperborean times, and it needs to suffuse our souls. It is this of which we need to take account. Otherwise, if human beings don't open their eyes and their souls to these great evolutionary spurs in human advancement, the earth will proceed in a false evolutionary direction, one not constituting healthy loam for cosmic growth and ascendant world construction. Everything representing the final phase in earth evolution will then have to be taken up by another planet. Enormous interests are at stake. It is essential to work your way out of parochial, bigoted, bourgeois philostrosity and to evolve upward to greater, wider interests. Only when you have acquired such broader interests are you able to correctly evaluate certain phenomena in our present. It can clearly be seen that human natures are now diverging. This is in its infancy today, yet humanity is beginning to diverge in two directions. One direction manifests natures in whom, to some extent, the physical corporeal element is being hardened. In this element, they develop a certain hardness up to the age of 27, then remain at a standstill, rejecting everything of a soul spiritual nature. If they are not continually stimulated to incite humanity, to lead humanity toward disaster, as Lloyd George, then they congeal, they stagnate sourly, they turn to extreme philistinism and become dulled. People become stunted in this divergent direction. Those in the other direction submit until the age of 27 to the drives and forces pulsating from their physical corporeal nature, extracting all spirituality from it. Much lies in this physical corporeal nature. Do not forget that we all arrive in this world as immensely wise beings. We would only need to transform this wisdom into consciousness, transform all the latent wisdom existing in our corporeality. Spiritual science tries, in a harmonious and spiritually suffused way, to retrieve all that lives in blood, nerves, and muscle, and raise it upward into consciousness. Spiritual science is rejected not only by stunted individuals, but also widely by those, and there will be more and more of them, who feel buoyantly what lives, pulsates, boils, and seethes as ingenuity and resourcefulness down among their nerves, blood, and muscles, until sexual maturity and as far as the age of 27. These overheated natures, who to some extent burn up human life, are becoming more and more numerous. They already crop up sporadically and ever more frequently in considerable numbers. Mental institutions and similar facilities are peopled with them. Yet any insight into the fact that anthroposophically oriented spiritual science represents a real source of healing is absent. One such nature typical of recent times, who achieved world fame, is the philosopher Otto Weininger. Otto Weininger was a person who, in the most chaotic, unreconstructed, and disharmonious way, retrieved what lay in nerve, blood, and muscle, and then wrote the world-famous book titled Sex and Character, for which the people who fall for everything also fell. So those Philistines fell for it, not realizing that despite all its repellent nonsense, it represented an idea, a manifestation of an element comprising blood, muscle, and nerves. Such people are faced with an elemental phenomenon. It confronts them from out of their own humanity. And spiritual science wishes to develop this, but in a harmonious and orderly manner. Because they have not learned it from spiritual science, where they could properly have done so, such people need, because their nerves, blood, and muscles demand it, to ask themselves the very question which humanity as a whole urgently needs to ask. Without this question, humanity cannot progress any further. The question is this: how can I, by being in the physical world since birth or conception, be the continuer, creating continuity for my soul's spiritual existence between my last death and this current birth? This and similar questions, as thrown up in spiritual science and viewed as fundamental questions in progressive spiritual culture, need to be brought to light, and will be brought to light by those who allow to seethe upward what exists in nerve, blood, and muscle. You see, one chapter in Otto Weininger is extraordinarily interesting. He asked himself, why did I actually enter into terrestrial existence? He asked this question on the basis of what I have just characterized, out of the wisdom slumbering in nerves, blood, and muscle. And in his own way he answered his question, but in a way that consumes and burns the human being. He asked, why have I been drawn from the spirit-soul realm, in which I used to dwell, into life on earth? He found no other answer other than this: because I was cowardly, because I didn't want to stay alone in the soul's spiritual world, and hence I sought connection with other people. I didn't have the courage to remain alone and sought refuge in my mother's body. These were to him entirely honest answers that he was giving himself. Why do we have no memories, he asked, of the time that flowed past before birth? Because that is how we became at birth. He said literally, because we have sunk so low that we have lost consciousness of it. Had human beings not lost themselves at birth, they would not need to seek and refind themselves. And these are typical phenomena. They still arise sporadically nowadays. It is people such as these who in their youth extract from blood, nerve, and muscle what can only become digestible over the course of the entire process of being human, once it is purified and made harmonious by what spiritual science should be offering. But for this to happen, the breadth and magnitude of interests throughout human life have to be vastly expanded. All bourgeois pettiness, all philostrosity has to recede. People being sealed off in narrow interest huddles has to be systematically combated. Certain questions have to be framed quite differently than has so far been the case. How did religious evolution of the past millennia itself frame the question that still connects a few people with the spiritual? A materialistically educated, witty, modern man, occupying a prestigious position in certain circles, once said to me, if you compare the state with the church, you arrive at the view that the church has an easier ride than the state. Now, I don't wish to comment on the relative value of such an opinion, but that man meant that the church has an easier time of it than does the state, because the state governs life, whereas the church, as it were, reigns over death. People being more afraid of death than they are of life, the church has an easier job. He obviously considered this to be nonsense because he was of dyed-in-the-wool materialistic outlook. But this topic, too, has been driven into fairly egotistical channels. Basically, people today ask, what happens in my soul's spiritual life when I have gone through the gate of death? Therein lie many egotistical impulsions. Particularly the question of immortality would take on a very different guise under the influence of spiritual science. In future, people would not only ask, to what extent is soul's spiritual life after death a continuation of life here on earth? Instead, they would ask, to what extent is life here on earth a continuation of the life I spent earlier in soul's spiritual worlds? In the latter case, we would be able to look at the following. When a human being goes through the gate of death, imaginative conceptualizing is initially very strongly established. A compendious pictorial world is imaginatively rolled out before them. I'd like to call this the unfurling of an image-filled world. The second third of life between death and a new birth is primarily filled with inspiration. Inspirations arise in this second third of life between death and a new birth, and it is intuitions that predominate in the last third. Now, intuitions consist in human beings transposing themselves with self and soul into other beings, and the ultimate intuitive transposition consists in transiting into a physical body. This transposing of oneself into a physical body through birth is just the continuation of a primarily intuitive life in the final third between death and a new birth. And what must actually arise when a human being steps into physical existence must show up in a child as a particularly characteristic trait, this transposition into a different life. The child has to do what others do, not what originates in their own self, but by imitating and mimicking what others do. Why did I have to describe, when talking about the education of the child from the perspective of spiritual science, how children in the first 7 years of their lives are primarily imitators? Because imitating, that transposing yourself into others, is a continuation of the intuitive world of the last third of existence between death and a new birth. You can still see, streaming into and illuminating their lives, that existence between death and rebirth, if you observe children's lives in a meaningful way. It is therefore around this fact that the question of immortality will have to be framed, thus, to what extent is life here on earth a continuation of life between death and a new birth? You will then learn to take this life on earth especially seriously, but not in an egotistical sense. Above all, it will be a matter of holding on to a feeling of responsibility, felt in such a way that you reflect, I have to continue here what I was enjoined to do, in that I have brought with me a legacy from soul spiritual worlds. It will represent an enormous about turn in people's conceptions once they speak from this other perspective. Because what the soul experiences between death and a new birth, this vast spiritual vista experienced in imagination, inspiration, and intuition, is for that realm the here and now. And what we experience here is for that realm the yonder. And wanting to understand this yonder, wanting to revere and recognize it, will become part of the newly framed question about immortality, which will intervene in spiritual evolution in a less egotistical way than did the question of immortality so widely throughout the evolution of religions in past millennia. I wanted to describe these things in order to show how humanity can break free of petty Philistine bigotry and to illustrate what it is not to be a Philistine. You are not a Philistine if you can go beyond those narrowest of interests, if you can evince an interest in the fact that here on earth you breathe 25,950 times a day, which equates both with the number of days in a lifetime and also with the number of shifts made by the sun as it completes its circumnavigation of cosmic ellipses. Broadening your interest to include what led to there being a forgotten stream within German spiritual life, broadening your interest to encompass what is being configured in the spiritual life of the entire world, what the underlying gestures of Eastern, Central, and Western spiritual evolution are, how Asiatic spiritual evolution depends to some extent on an Eastern stream which became decadent in the West, how the Central stream, once dependent on a Southern cultural influx, will in future become dependent on the North. Interests such as these can lead us out into the great scheme of human evolution, to overcoming philistrosity, to rightly disposing feeling toward human evolution, and to teaching us genuinely to empathize with impulses alive throughout humanity. And as for willing, willing also evolves in a specific way under the influences of materialism. It evolves such that human beings become ever less adroit, ever clumsier, that is, in the great classical sense of less adept and more inept. What can human beings do today? The most restricted work for which they are trained sets them within small groupings. Whatever spiritual science develops in terms of concepts, feeling, and impulsions of will enters right down into limbs. When a person lives into spiritual science, they become adept, nimble. They can adapt to their environments. They learn over the course of their lives skills for which one might have said, when they were quite small, that they had not the slightest talent. When spiritual science is properly grasped, it makes individuals increasingly deft. Nowadays, people are less handy, even on the most modest scale. You meet people who do not have a handle on the smallest tasks. You meet men who cannot even sew on a button that has ripped off, let alone anything else. Much depends on people becoming more versatile once more, that they become capable of adapting to their environments, that the limitations are overcome of being enclosed within constricted circles, and hence becoming inept for the world. However odd it may sound, humanity has this threefold task for the present and the near future in relation to thinking, feeling, and willing. That petty, narrow-mindedness be overcome, and that mobility in finding your way into world circumstances gains ground. That Philistinism is conquered, and open-hearted interest takes hold of human hearts. That clumsy ineptitude is remedied, and people once more become skilled. That people are educated to dexterity in the most varied areas of life, and learning to understand the world in the widest possible areas of life. Today, the opposite of all this is, of course, being perpetrated. People are being corralled into dyspraxia, into narrow-minded philistrosity, and these are the predictable consequences of a materialistic mindset. Of course, not everyone who has broken their leg can learn how to reset it themselves. But clumsiness need not extend to people having no sense as to how to help themselves in the simplest of illnesses and such like. Dexterous, smart understanding, so as to be equal to dealing with the most diverse of situations in life. Crucially, that is what it depends on. Haven't we seen, in the way this recent time has come about, how things have been developing? To anyone with eyes that could see events of recent decades, and to those who asked around, it was clear that actually having the sense to develop a worldview, having the sense to make the impetus behind worldviews the focus of their observation, that only those with lively enough motivation of will to develop purely materialist interest in worldviews were those active in the area of socialism. Basically, it was only among those who wanted to reform the world in a socialist direction and who had observed social conditions that any question about world views arose at all. Once you went beyond the socialist deluge, there was a lack of interest, or at best a few narrow niche interests, clinging onto old handed-down ideas. Or, if anything new was being conceptualized, it was the abstract wordage that anticipated Wilsonism, as it raged particularly rampantly among so-called liberal parties in the second half of the 19th century. Any will to actively enter into the spiritual divine impulses of the world, in the way socialism wanted to enter into all things material, will of this kind was absent. Dull obtuseness there was aplenty among the upper echelons of the bourgeoisie, where it had begun in the first place. There are, of course, exceptions. Those present, as politeness dictates, are obviously among them. Now, in order to place yourselves in a position facing these phenomena and asking yourselves such questions as have been raised today, as also answering them as we have tried to do, is fundamentally one and the same thing, because enormous issues are at stake here. In Eastern Europe, we see how something is being, as I'd like to frame it, prepared for in essence, in extract, about which Europe has terrifyingly little understanding. These seeds of Eastern European evolution have often been mentioned around our regions, and today I will express it in a specific form. Eastern Europe wants to come to the understanding that all human life has meaning. When the sixth cultural epoch approaches, Eastern Europe is intended to show earthly evolution that all human life contains meaning, that we are not just to take as gospel what has been funneled into us at school in our youth. The East is destined to demonstrate that human beings continue to develop until their death, that each year brings ever more and more new discoveries, and that when we go through the gate of death, we remain connected with the earth, while wisdom continues to be garnered after death. What does that soul element long for, which until recently could be called Russian, and which is now temporarily heading into chaos, but which will find its way as part of Europe's cultural evolution and, thence, into the entire evolution of all humankind? What does this Eastern element actually want? It wants to see an emerging sense for the fact that all human life is involved in evolving, and that the moment of death is just another such moment, albeit an exceptionally important one, in this evolution. This principle also has to find its adherents and believers in Central Europe, and will do so under the conditions here introduced. But until that principle is recognized, the belief will always prevail that the younger one is, the more one is entitled to an opinion. Those youngest of whippersnappers, both male and female, have their firmly shuttered and conclusive viewpoints and have basically no space in themselves for great expectations and hopes. That with each passing year, new mysteries will be unveiled, and that the instant of death will likewise reveal new mysteries. In the East, souls are evolving who, still in their unconscious, are beginning to understand that human beings are at their wisest and can be the best judges of earthly affairs and conditions precisely when they die. From among such souls living in the East, there will emerge those who don't merely inquire from young whippersnappers and parliaments how to organize human affairs, but who will also ask of the dead and will learn to communicate with the dead, making this connection fruitful for earthly evolution. In future, it will be a question of asking what the dead have to say in a given situation. Spiritual ways will be found of asking not only the living but also the dead when it is a matter of resolving great human conundrums here on earth. If you deepen yourselves sufficiently through spiritual science, the spiritual means will be found to query not only the living but also the dead about the great decisions facing humanity on earth. That is what the East wants. Never before has there been such a collision between elements so badly suited to each other as what is happening today in Eastern Europe. Because what constitutes the soul of Eastern Europe is the polar opposite of the Trotskyism and Leninism of present times, which out of the purest, if most self-deluding, materialistic Leninism, that most bleak caricature of human cultural progress, has no sense for nor comprehension of real spirituality, yet which so understandably grows on the basis of the present's underlying mood. The future will learn to recognize this. That, my dear friends, is what I wanted to say to you by way of summarizing what is intended, what ought, to kindle interest in your hearts. We need to acquire an understanding for this. We cannot be allowed to remain dull and uninterested in what, in the deepest sense, goes on in souls. That is what I wanted during our meeting here, to lay in your souls and in your hearts. And that is the end of Lecture 12, the last lecture of Collected Works, Volume 174a by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History. And these lectures were given for members of the Anthroposophical Society held in Munich between the 13th of September 1914 and 4 May 1918.